There's going to be a migration north because of climate. And so personally, I have accepted that there's going to be a migration, that we're going to see temperatures become more extreme, that it's going to be harder to do ranching and farming in the places where we've done it, and that we need to learn from Australia. We need to learn from Israel. We need to learn from the Middle East as to what they're doing with water and with transporting water and measuring water. And it's not something we need to freak out about. There are solutions. But just like with fire management, we seem to get caught up in the argument about what caused it and not get to solving it. So I think it's very important that we shift our mindset to, let's just start solving some of these problems with technologies that are out there and successful. And let's help the people who make this their business stay in business, especially when it's a generational business like ranching.
It's time for conversations about our food and how it's grown on Farm to Table Talk with your host, Roger Wasson.
I can't think of a better way to start a day than meeting good friends at a coffee shop, especially if we have some common interest. Well, fortunately, I can still meet people and have the effect of a coffee shop, but we can't really go there as much as we used to. And we couldn't anyway too well, because my guests today are quite a ways apart. One of them's in Canada, and the other one is in Southern California, and I'm in Northern California. But ladies, it's going to be like we're at a coffee shop, that we're coming in and talking about something, a shared interest that we have, and that is agriculture and what's happening in food and farming and using technology. And again, I think we could sit down and say, well, let's chat about these things. And you two have chatted too with each other. You've been in programs before when we were able to do some traveling and attending meetings in person. But today we're doing it via Zoom, like so many of these other conversations that are taking place. I really want to welcome Deborah Wilson and Christine McRae. Say, it's great to sit down and have a cup of coffee with you two and have a conversation. I'm going to ask you, as you know something about each other, why don't you each introduce the other person? Deborah, do you want to go first?
Sure. So thanks so much for having us into your little coffee clutch, Roger. And Christine and I are really excited about it. Christine and I are kindred spirits in that we really worry about the planet. We worry about food for people. And we worry about the continuation of the agriculture industry and how it can meet the demands of the consumer. So Christine, I know, comes from the technology and actually the human health sector, which the human health sector, you know, ties closely into agri-food. And she is now a partner in a company called West Sky Technologies that's looking at providing technology, industry advancement, and industry development, and artificial AI to agricultural producers. So we've bonded over a lot of issues, and you're probably going to hear about some of them today.
And now it's my turn. So Deb and I got in touch a number of months ago as I was learning more about the U.S. Roundtable for Sustainable Beef. The Canadian example was a highlight at the meeting a year and a half ago. And I thought, I need to meet some of the folks who've been part of this, and was able to track down Deb Wilson of Trustbix, who is the Chief Industry Engagement Officer, as one of the key players who's made it happen, and really learn from behind the scenes, how did it happen? How did the incentives work? How did the mechanics work and the certifications? And what I love most about Deb is she is a rancher, Wilson Cattle Ranch, Wilson Cattle Company, and so she brings that perspective that is rare of understanding how to do incentives, how to build technology, and what the ranchers really need. And she's also just a wonderful person to listen to, as I'm sure you'll see.
Well, you know, Deb, that's quite an introduction, too. You both did a great job of introducing each other. Well, one advantage that, Deb, that you have is you could actually walk out your door and find your way to some real cows. I mean, we're sitting around.
Oh, I can do that.
and I'm jealous of that. You know, we're sitting in our home offices and doing what we do right now and talking about agriculture in kind of an abstract kind of fashion. But you can get your fill of that and then the new technology and the trends and policies and so forth. But, yeah, how far do you have to go to see a cow to actually from where you sit?
Oh, maybe 900 feet if I go out my back door. I won't necessarily see a cow. What I will see will be our ranch horses and our herd bulls. The cows are a little further out.
Okay. And then there's a certain time of year you put the herd bulls out, but it's not time to be breeding yet.
Most of these guys have come home. They're pretty mellow. They've been out all summer with their girls. So they're ready to come home and, like most males, put their feet up and relax.
I'm trying to envision that. That's one that's hard to kind of conjure up. But that's something you're not going to replace with artificial intelligence. But there are a few artificial elements to these things anymore. But one more painting that picture, though. Again, if we're out at the ranch, what's a ranch look like? If let's say, okay, we're going to go out and, you know, jump in a pickup with you and drive out through the fields. What's the territory look like in your part of Alberta?
You know what? Alberta is very, it's hugely varied. It's, we go right from arid grasslands in the south and irrigation farming in the south all the way up to the central Alberta area where we go into the parklands. And east central Alberta is, again, arid grasslands, hard grass country. The central part of Alberta, higher rainfall. We grow higher yields with our crops. So smaller holdings with higher yields. Basically all fenced. We've had a ranch in eastern Alberta where the ranch is fenced into sections. I've been on ranches where they're measured by miles. I've been on a ranch we worked with that we sorted cattle for, and they bought bulls from us, and the ranch was 2 miles wide and 8 miles long. So, and yet, you know, you can go down to a very small holding a rancher might have 30 cows. And we're seeing, Christine and I just talked about this the other day, there seems to be a desire from certain sectors in the urban population that want to get out of the city, and they want to start to develop their own small farm or their mini ranchette kind of thing. And we were talking about these people coming out to do this, and do they have any knowledge of livestock, and do they know how to move forward? And they're also excited to get out of the city, and their kids are going to have a wholesome, healthy life. But at the end of the day, I think one of the points that I've always made to my kids is whether you have a dog, a cat, a chicken, or a cow or a horse, if it's a domestic animal, you're responsible for its well-being. And that's one thing Christine and I talked about is, do these people that are exiting the urban centers that want to become, well, they want to be ranchers, and it's great they have that passion, but how and where do they learn about it? And do they really fully realize the responsibility that at the end of the day that your animals need to eat before you do? Doesn't matter what the conditions are, what the weather is, whether it's a fire, a drought, a raging blizzard, which we have up here in the north. And, do these people understand this responsibility that ranchers take on?
You know, that it's an interesting perspective. And Christine, you live in an area that is one of the largest, I guess, maybe the second largest metropolitan area in the United States. And lately I'm hearing of people that are saying they are doing just what she was just describing, what Deb was saying, said, I want to kind of get out of here. And in fact, it's interesting because everybody being shut down and working from home is in a way having a relationship, I think, to people maybe discovering livestock or small farming operations, because they don't necessarily have to live in Los Angeles and still do their jobs, and then they can go out to the fringe areas. And I'm just wondering if you're running into or aware of stories like that, that are people are saying, gee, I can work from home now. I can work anywhere. I don't have to go to the office. And then the second thing they do after they get their place away from the larger metropolitan area is say, I wonder if I can have cows, or I wonder if I can have chickens, or, you know, I wonder if I can start doing this vegetables I can produce and sell at a farmer's market. Are you running into any of those kind of stories?
Definitely. And in different ways. I think it's important to remember that Southern California used to be agricultural, and in some cases it's less than a generation away. Cerritos, I live adjacent to Cerritos, used to be dairy town. The new developments are built on dairy fields and farms. And so two things I've been looking at. One is there's a large community of horsemen and folks who own goats and folks who own sheep. And I actually had a call yesterday with a halal meat processor that works with home ranchers that might have a few goats or sheep. They're probably Muslim because it's a halal shop. And they actually do things in accordance with the religious practices with folks who are raising sheep and goats and some cows within Los Angeles County in San Bernardino, which surprised me a bit. I was actually looking for a way to get my son involved in 4-H living in the city. And what I found is the Orange County Fairgrounds have a small farm and you can actually sign up in LA to raise animals, including beef and dairy. And so remembering that Southern California is actually more agricultural than you think is part of it. But yes, definitely seeing folks who are saying, even 10 years ago, a gentleman from United Health Group where I used to work, retired, bought a bunch of goats, moved up to Sacramento, and now he's making beautiful goat cheese. And so I think it's part of the fantasy of an early retirement is getting back to the land.
You know, decades ago, people were fretting about how we're going to get down to the fact that there might be like one rancher and one farmer in the entire North America, because they thought, well, it's going to be this great big corporate structure. And as we start moving larger and larger, there'll be fewer and fewer farmers. But at least currently, that's really different. And you know what I kind of wonder as we're describing this, is it sort of like certain things you used to have to go import them from a factory in China to get all these different parts. But now you've got people that are inventing things with like 3D printers. And you're finding that the technology is also supporting scaling smaller. And it just kind of makes me wonder if this isn't a similar paradox.
I hope so.
I'll
go and then throw it to you.
No.
Yeah. So I think so. But for the folks who are the very small farmers and ranchers, finding hook space, finding a way to process that meat is extremely difficult. And entering the market, because there's a huge domination of that meat processing market by three or four companies, it's very difficult. So the opportunity is you raise a few, you might be able to sell them at an auction, but it's very tough to enter the market and make a living until you meet a certain threshold. And so will they be able to go from being what's called a hobby farm to being ranchers? And will there be assistance for them to do that? And I think there's some good news. The USDA is looking at this. There are groups that are working hard to make sure that generational ranchers can stay in business. But I do think there's still risks because it's hard to sell direct because of the meat processing situation. Deb, shall I throw it to you?
Yeah, I mean, we have the same situation. We have two major packers that you would recognize their names. They also are prevalent in the U.S., they're prevalent here in Canada. And we do need more slaughter capacity in Canada. Recently, the Alberta government softened some of their regulations around small local abattoirs, packers, which was really welcome. And then, of course, when COVID hit, we had we have two of the biggest packing plants. We process, I'm going to say, 70 to 80% of the slaughter cattle in Canada here in Alberta. When COVID hit, we did have one of our biggest plants shut down for 2 to 3 weeks. We had the other plant had to back off on the speed of its line, so it has less capacity. This was all happening in April. So my grandkids are in 4-H. They are raising their 4-H calves, which would typically be sold at a, they'd be shown at a public show, sold at a public sale. Families would come there to buy their steers. Some of the steers would end up at the major packer. Some people would buy the steers to take home and share with a neighbor or somebody else, that we'd split the meat once it was harvested. And this year, because of the backup in harvest capacity, these small and mid-sized abattoirs were booked. Like, even right now, we're so far behind. I had our neighbor bought a steer from us. She spent days and days trying to find an abattoir that could take this animal in under 4 to 5 months. So, and the crazy part is the animal's ready now. So my grandkids, because there was no sale, they did up their own little flyer of their family raised steers, took pictures, told the story about all the steers. And my 15-year-old granddaughter made her mom drive her around, and she went to all the local businesses, all the family friends. She drove to a nearby big center, handed it out to the restaurants. She was marketing 3 fat steers that would weigh about 1,400 pounds. And, you know, I was so proud of her that she took on that initiative. And interestingly, one of the restaurants bought that steer from her. So he wants to be able to tell that story. But then the struggle is finding, when you're selling to the restaurant industry, it's got to be a government approved. It's got to be a higher standard than where I might go for an abattoir to harvest my meat for my own use. So right now, my husband and I are eating part of Bobby, and Bobby's fantastic. He's raised with love and given a lot of care and fed the best feed. And so when you talk about going back to these smaller niche type of situations, I attend a lot of events publicly, and I also like sit on the Canadian Roundtable for Sustainable Beef, and I interact with a lot of industry stakeholders, as well as environmentalists and animal rights activists, and they'll tell me all the things we do wrong and why, how we're harming the environment. And I usually stop the conversation midstream and go, how was your garden this year? And they stop and they look at me and they go, we weren't talking about the garden. I said, well, no, I realize that you're very concerned about feeding your family and you want to feed your family the best quality food. So do you live in a house in the city? And they look at me like I'm crazy. Of course I do. I said, well, you know, how's your garden in your backyard? How are your carrots? I found my lettuce matured early this year. And it stops them dead, Roger, because you know what? We all have that opportunity to have that garden in our backyard and be able to help feed our families and teach our kids about growing food. So yeah. I'm going to leave my little spiel right there.
Well, no, I want to pick up on your little spiel, because that you made me think of it. When I was a little kid, I remember that we would take a beef or a hog or a lamb into the local locker plant, but you never paid to have it done. What you do is that they would process it, and then they would keep some of the meat that they would sell directly. So we always kind of wondered whether or not they took a little more hamburger than they should have sometimes. But and the other thing the local locker plants could be able to do then was they could sell it locally. People could come in and, like you said, they know there's this 4-H deer that's been processed and saying, hey, Frank, can you save me a few steaks from that one? And you come in, pick it up. It's all wrapped and frozen. You go back and put it in the freezer, which is the other thing we used to do way back then. We all had these huge freezers. I miss the freezer now. Now it just needs to be big enough to be able to put some pizzas in, you know. But back when people used to be able to get a half a beef or, you know, or a whole hog or some lambs and so forth. But what's interesting to me is that something you both alluded to is that today that's kind of happening again, and not just in rural areas, but you're having these communities, and I believe that, Christine, you were kind of alluding to that too, in these neighborhoods that people are looking for different kind of processing. People are coming from that have immigrated to the LA area, for example, and they're wanting to get lamb that's processed a certain way and so forth. And they're doing private treaties, and they're going outside of every major city in America that they're going out into these areas and trying to make arrangements to get some product direct. Now,
yeah, and I would add, well, go ahead.
No, that's fine. I'm trying
and
to figure
even
out
more mainstream, most of the ranchers I know are talking about getting a producer-owned meat processing plant. There's one coming up in Ogden that we're hearing about. There's some in Colorado where producer, that means rancher, that they can have some sort of ownership in the plant to then help control where the meat goes, how it's processed, the calendaring, and have a little bit of certainty. Selling direct is more profitable than selling at an auction to someone else who takes it to a feedlot. And yet, it can also cost more because that last mile, everybody calls it in supply chain, right, processed and getting out to the stores can be very cumbersome. A rancher, we're actually finishing some cattle right now to pilot direct to consumer with a rancher in Colorado. And we just had three animals go to slaughter. We're waiting to get the finals. But what happened in Colorado, there was a meat plant that burned down. There were other plants that were closed. It goes to one plant for slaughter. It goes to another plant to be processed. It then gets tested to be sure there's no bacteria or problems. And then it gets packaged and sent. So it's very cumbersome. And this rancher literally is driving 3 or 4 days a week, dropping off livestock, picking up meat, getting tests back, dropping it off to different stores, grocery stores. And when you go into those stores, it says Coberstein beef. Folks know Roger Coberstein. But he does this work himself. It's a lot of work. And I don't see it as something that's scalable for your new family farms coming in from the city or for your established generational farms. We've got to have some changes in the number of small and medium meat processing plants to create a fair supply chain.
You know, when you were describing this project in Colorado, you're helping me transition from philosophy to business. Because I assume your company is not intentionally nonprofit. Maybe we all are nonprofit sometime, but there is a business aspect. I mean, what do you have to do with that? What is it that you do that has you looking at a project in Colorado that making these kind of connections?
So I'm looking at two things. One, coming out of healthcare, where you have basically business rules, recommendation engines working on different diagnoses. So you have diabetes, you have a scale, you might have an insulin glucose monitor that works with you to figure out your diet. So if you were, I'm going to potentially offend some people, but if you were looking at cattle, looking at diet, looking at body mass index instead of body condition score, feed versus the food you eat, and then getting to automated alerts that say you've got some cattle that aren't eating, they aren't drinking, they could be sick, or you've got some that they're pretty much fat and ready to go. And then getting into the nutrition. So I've just, I think it was the Sustainable Dish this morning, saw something presented about the nutrition of pasture raised versus feedlot raised. And I don't want to suggest in any way that the U.S. beef supply chain isn't healthy, because I think we have one of the best supply chains in the world. But I personally believe that pasture raised beef that walks on high mountains, that grazes what it's hungry for, is going to be extremely nutritious when we consume it. And I'd like to be able to prove that using sensors, using technology, and then help the ranchers keep the rights of access to their land. So one of the tools we're looking at is grazing as a service, as an ecological service. So fire containment, active fuel management, keeping out of sensitive areas, because there are folks that will actively try to stop ranchers from getting access to traditional generational grazing areas. Mm-hmm. For reasons that they consider important. Can't we come together when we talk about forest management as a cause of fires in California? The opportunity isn't to argue about climate change. It's to say, okay, great, how do we use grazing as an ecological service to reduce fire risk without impacting sensitive species? So we're looking at satellite ear tags. We're looking at geofencing. We're doing a survey where we're talking to the different forest management teams. You'll have range consultants and USDA extension specialists that work on these projects. How do you automate what they know? Just like in healthcare, you can automate all the rules around diabetes or congestive heart failure and put it into a system and give people alerts that say, hey, what's going on? You're at risk. Can't we use some of this technology now that the prices have come down and make it accessible to ranchers? So one is grazing as a service, and the next is direct to that eco-minded consumer who will pay that premium. So we're piloting with Local Line, which is a Canadian virtual food hub, to look at, can we build some food hubs that connect your meat processors, your small and medium processors, with multiple owners of livestock, that helps you work with the existing rules around state-inspected plants with what's selling to friends and family. So right now, when Deb says she went to a processing plant that was not federally inspected, it was, in her case, provincially, or in our case, state inspected, that can't sell across state lines. There are different rules. So what ranchers will do is they'll go to their local state inspected plant that might have more bandwidth to schedule, and then they'll sell to their friends and family, two or three cattle. Can we use a mechanism like that? This is what we're trying to find out, to free it up. And so at legislative areas, they are looking at loosening some of the rules. But you also don't want to get people sick. You don't want to be in a situation where you listen to it so much that you hurt the confidence in it. So that intersection of policy, technology, and the profitability of the ranch is what we're playing with. And we're piloting different technologies, basically from Canada and Ireland. And then our goal is, as we have data, to start to build those recommendations in so that ranchers will know, oh, you've got some cows out on the highway. Don't wait for the sheriff to call. You've got some in an area that, so keep the right to your land. And by the way, there's an upcoming fair in the halal community, and they're looking for 30 cows. Can you be ready? Can you have them fat by May?
You know what I love about this conversation is that it's such a huge area. It's kind of like, you know, we're having our little virtual party here of a coffee break, sort of, with three of us. But to me, I'm kind of thinking this is almost like if you had a party, you're going to have thousands of people, and they got all kinds of different interests, and you try to have everybody have a good time. You know, that it's that you're taking care of all these different needs. And somehow, when I look at farming and agriculture and these problems that we're relating to right now, is that technology may be enabling us to accommodate the needs and interests of a really, really diversified group. And it's the opposite of where we thought we were heading with specialization, that there was going to have to be a one-size-fits-all, that in fact the technology is enabling us to have many sizes fitting many, many, and many consumers' needs and that information. And I find that really exciting. And Deb, she was mentioning something too about satellite ear tags. You know, they just, you know, I wanted to stop you back then, Christine, because a lot of people say satellite ear tags. But Deb, you have some experience with tracking information about your livestock. If I'm not mistaken, you were also involved at a bull test station, which I think that kind of probably had ear tags that let them get into certain places so you could measure what they're eating and so forth. But I'm wondering if some of the points, you know, that Christine was bringing up there that you connect with from your perspective and your experience.
Oh, you know, that's such a loaded question. So back in the day in the 80s, we did not have even radio frequency ID tags, which are passive, that have to be read by a reader. So today we've got tags that are bounce off a satellite. We've got tags that ping off of towers on our and they send out a ping every so many minutes to preserve the battery life. We've got collars that go around cattle that allow them to eat a specific amount of feed. We've got ultrasounding techniques that check for back fat. I mean, all of these are tools to better raise animals. And I know Christine believes in grass-fed beef. I believe the one thing I do know about feedlot practices in both Canada and the U.S. have improved growth performance and feed efficiency. and also have environmental benefits by using, for example, less feed per pound of beef. So we have less reduced manure output. The animals are on feed for a shorter period of time, minimizes their carbon footprint. And I'll give you an example. In Canada, in the last 30 to 40 years, we've the Canadian domestic slaughter has decreased 20%, while beef production itself has increased 11%. So that means we're running 20% less cattle, but we're producing 11% more meat. So we can take and translate that into minimizing our carbon footprint. And when we talk about what my company does, what Trust Bix does, is we have worked with McDonald's, and now we're into, you know, year five of producing sustainable beef and delivering it to the marketplace. That all has to be tracked with a chain of custody. So if you go to the CRSB, Canadian Roundtable for Sustainable Beef website, everybody that is in that, every stakeholder in that chain is third-party audited. So we can really put our money where our mouth is and say, we can prove we're doing what we say we're doing. But at the end of the day, there's a million, let's say there's 1,000 different ways people want their food. So halal is one. Grass-fed's another. Sustainable is another. Certain breed of cattle is another. I mean, the Angus breed itself has done a phenomenal job of promoting the attributes of Angus cattle. So at the end of the day, the consumer has a right to choice. We have to give them the tools that validate their choices and tell the right story. And so that story can be linked to production practices, harvest practices, how the meat is processed post-harvest. And I think the example of my granddaughter going out and selling her 4-H calves, hers and her brothers and sisters' 4-H calves, it just reinforces to me that people want that connection to how their food is raised. They want that story. I have a son that will only buy his meat. He's a lawyer in the city. He's now spent more time in his life in the city than he ever did on the ranch. He was one of those kids, was in 4-H, you know, worked cattle at the chute, rode a horse, did all those things. And when it came time to go to university, I always kid around and say, yeah, there was nothing but skid marks when you drove out the driveway to go to university. And he's never been back. But you know what? He's happy. He lives in the city. He grows a little garden in the backyard with his kids so they learn about their food. It's big excitement to come to Nana's house, collect the eggs. They understand where their eggs come from. And he buys his meat when he can't get it from us. He goes to a niche market store who tells the story about the meat. And I said, do you pay more there, Mark? He goes, of course I pay more. And he said, but I want to know I'm feeding my family the best I can feed them. And I can afford to pay for the story. He said, when I lived on the ranch, Mom, I watched what we did with our cattle. And I think that's all the urban consumer is asking for, is they don't have to know every nitty-gritty detail, but they want to know that somebody does, and that if they really wanted to check into it, that the program would be robust enough that they could feel good about what they were eating. So I hope that makes sense, or where you wanted to go with that part.
That makes perfect sense. One of the things that we're talking about here won't surprise many people, that it's very similar, your perspective in Canada to ours in the U.S. as far as what consumers are wanting, the stories. But you also are involved with consumers in Japan and programs that are international. I wonder what you both feel about to what extent this that we're speaking of is a global phenomenon, or is it just certain countries around the world, or versus kind of where North America stands compared to where Europe or Asia might, their interest in these issues?
Oh, the EU has just, they're 10 years ahead of us in their demands. And Ireland has been a country that has learned that they can really add value to their agricultural production by telling the story. So they have some excellent, excellent programs that the Irish farmers participate in. And one of the things that's key and critical is you need to, as you collect these stories, you have to have a way to bring these stories together to and to be able to validate it with, again, a robust program. Nothing drives me crazier than when I see a half-baked marketing program on TV for a food product that deliberately misleads or misconstrues the practices of our producers. Because our producers, at the end of the day, like Christine talks about human health, at the end of the day, our producers are producing food that their families are eating, and they're doing it to the best of their ability to share it with the people in their local communities and in the cities. So while we go back to hook space, how can the local rancher share what he produces with his people, you know? And it could be goats, it could be lamb, it could be pork. We've lost all those little niche market industries because there's no local abattoirs anymore. We've regulated this industry to the point where we can't have that entrepreneurial spirit. And Christine's talking about that, you know. How, if I want to sell locally, how do I do that as a rancher? Who do I go to?
Right. Yeah, it's an important question. And what I'm seeing internationally is a different kind of investment in ag tech. I mean, the buzzword for what we're talking about here is precision agriculture, just like you have precision medicines, being able to have the intelligent, have the sensor data, have the supervised learning from experts that can then use technology to do good things, whether it's permaculture or ranching or things that typically have been hard to scale. I believe that if you use technology wisely, it will actually enable individuals and add to sovereignty of small businesses. Now, the other side of that is you have the Amazon mindset of big business, big supply chain. And so I think it's important that we also think about the Cargills and the McDonald's and that large supply chain. My hope is we're able to create niche supply chain channels within the larger environment. That's my hope. I have the same hope for human healthcare, that as United Health Group, where I used to work, is expanding, that, that precision medicine on the ground and in the homes will also be accessible. And so I'm actually an optimist about all of this. What I see in England specifically, I'm on the advisory committee for the LARTA Institute. And a year ago, when we met in person, that first day, you, I don't know if you were there, Roger, the UK presented their new research center. Millions of dollars being spent on ag tech integrated with farming, integrated with farmers and ranchers. And I was sitting next to the head of, I believe, sustainability from Lexington, who had just received a land grant from the university and was looking at this like, is this a model we can use? Now, I recognize differences in population and scale of land and that US is different from the UK. But we were both jealous. We both looked at what they were building, like, wouldn't it be beautiful if the way we look at land universities, land grant universities in the US, had that kind of integrated mindset? And what came to my mind was from 2.5 years ago when I went to England to look at how medical devices are being tested there. I went to a medical device conference, and they were showcasing how easy it is to test your medical device with the National Health Services because they have integrated partnerships with doctors who are their employees. So if you wanted to test your device and it was on their list of partnerships, you could get it through, you know, X times faster than in the US. And it reminded me of that, where now with ag tech, there's a funnel and a communication out and a mindset that supports innovation and that gets it commercialized and launched. And I think in the US, it's challenging as a small business owner to compete with that kind of acceleration model. And so it's not only that their consumers are demanding it, they're building innovation supply chains that make it easier. And that's part of the reason I'm calling Herdsy in Ireland and saying, hey, can we partner with you? Because if I build it myself, I'm 4 years behind. If I leverage what they're doing and then build data from there, perhaps we can catch up.
And you know, one of the, I was just going to say, one of the things that I find exciting about this too is that it's kind of the democratization of these technologies. Is that there was a time where people were saying, gee, what's the future in agriculture? And it only can be these really, really large scale versus, you know, niche and kind of dismissive, small, this and that, farmers of some sort. And it was kind of like shrugged off, like they didn't really quite matter. What's in fact happening is this technology that's expensive to develop is becoming more and more and more available to all sizes and shapes. And that's what nobody saw coming, or maybe I just didn't see it coming to the extent that it has, that these technologies that you're talking about right now are really not that hard to reach for somebody, whether they've got, 20 cows outside Edmonton or they've got 20,000 cows outside Amarillo. And the fact that that technology is connecting the world and connecting the marketers and connecting the consumers with the stories they want to hear all the way back to when a calf was born or when a crop was planted and so forth. I think that's just genius. It's we're watching a miracle unfold. So you guys got me too excited. That might be the caffeine. I'm kind of getting over caffeinated about this.
So let's now flip around and let's look at what's driving this corporately. When we look at all the fast-moving consumer good companies, and the investment community are looking to invest in companies that have strong ESGs, which is environmental sustainability goals. So all these companies have set their targets for 2030, 2050, and many of them have set very, very aggressive targets and did that a number of years ago. And that was again driven out of Europe, and it's now being even driven even more by the investment community. But so Christine and I have talked about this as all. We've talked about environmental and financial sustainability for producers. And so that goes hand in hand with creating viable carbon solutions for producers that could maybe be another additional revenue stream, and not just a revenue stream for the ranchers, but another way for them to tell their story about the great things they're doing, about how they sequester carbon, how they provide carbon credits back or carbon offsets to major corporations that need these things. So it's being driven, Roger, I think, that the need for data, the need for technology, it's been being driven from both ends. And it's about to collide in the middle. And we in the agriculture industry, and I'm so excited that my company gets to work with a unique group of producers that have gone through those sustainability audits. And many now have put their hands up to say, okay, I want to be part of the carbon play too. How do I take the carbon I sequester in my grasslands on my ranch? And how do I turn them into another revenue stream? And better yet, how do I tell that great story about that I don't harm the environment, that actually the manure from my cattle, if it's managed properly and tracked, that it's feeding the soil, it's keeping the soil alive, that I'm sequestering carbon in my grasslands, that I'm providing homes for species at risk. It's another thing we get challenged for in the livestock industry. We're taking away the habitat for species at risk. But let's turn that conversation around. If there's species at risk on your ranch, on your agricultural land, and you've had management of that land in agriculture it's been in agriculture for 100 years, and today you still have species at risk, whether it be grasses or birds or frogs or whatever the case may be, and they're still on your ranch, that's a good news story for agriculture. We have been great stewards of the land. So there's so many angles that we can go at to really connect with our sisters and brothers that live in an urban setting.
What was the acronym that you were talking about?
ESG.
ESG, so.
Yeah. Environment Sustainability Goals.
So did that come on the scene from a consumer standpoint, we know it's talked about. And we know the people that are pursuing doing having environmentally and sustainable goals. But how much of that is caused by the fact that that is what sells, that a consumer wanted to know that a company was actually committed to that? And in fact, it can be good for business if they're able to confirm that fact.
I think that's part of it. But I also think that there is widespread recognition of the science. And that in Europe, without the debate about is the science true, they're moving toward action. CDP, which I think stands for Climate Data Processing, has a lovely conference. I encourage you, if you want to learn more about this, to go to their site. They work with companies to set the targets and measure whether they're meeting them. And the tone, I attended their conference a few months ago, is simply, let's get to work. We need to reduce these various threshold numbers. And just yesterday, I was attending the Energy Sustainability Conference here in SoCal, AEE 2020, and they had the state of California talking about their targets. And the good news story is we've met the targets for 2020. Hooray. The next story was, how do we meet the targets for 2050, and can we bring them into 2045? And how do we do that? And what I was excited to see is their way of doing that was looking at working lands for carbon sequestration, because to make up the gap from energy to storing carbon underground in oil wells to reducing transportation risks, all of those things are important. But to meet their goals, natural and working lands need to be part of that. And that's everything from looking at biomass and turning it into biofuels, looking at waste, looking at the feedlots and capturing that methane, and really taking the action necessary. But nowhere have I heard a tone that's cynical or negative about, we're just doing this because the public's asking for it. It's more of a sense of urgency of, we need to do this or we're going to be dealing with the consequences. And I think the tone now more than ever is, we need to do this and we're going to be dealing with the consequences. Homegrown Minnesota is a group of folks looking at food security within Minneapolis. And when I was at Larch Institute, they had their member meeting. So I dropped by in the evening and kind of listened in. And they were talking about, they'd had a guy on a bike riding through the city, trying to figure out how many community gardens they have in people's backyards, how much food security, and then which neighborhoods. Certain neighborhoods are obviously different socioeconomics, or are there fewer gardens? And of course there were. And so how do we get enough urban gardens and community gardens to be food independent? They were thinking about it. And the thing that's interesting about that city is when you think about population migration from coasts that are getting hotter, Minneapolis is one of the biggest places people are going to. They're going north. They're going to Canada because that's where we're going to start growing our food. There's going to be a migration north because of climate. And so personally, I have accepted that there's going to be a migration, that we're going to see temperatures become more extreme, that it's going to be harder to do ranching and farming in the places where we've done it, and that we need to learn from Australia, we need to learn from Israel, we need to learn from the Middle East as to what they're doing with water and with transporting water and measuring water. And I've actually had conversations with companies in both of those areas about how they do it. And it's not something we need to freak out about. There are solutions. But just like with fire management, we seem to get caught up in the argument about what caused it and not get to solving it. So I think it's very important that we shift our mindset to, let's just start solving some of these problems with technologies that are out there and successful. And let's help the people who make this their business stay in business, especially when it's a generational business like ranching.
I love this. And Deb, you touched on something a minute or two ago, where you were talking about monetizing carbon sequestration, if I recall correctly, about how can, what are some of the things that can happen so that farmers can not only do the right thing because it's the right thing to do and they're motivated by it and people want them to, but actually possibly even earn some money from doing the right thing?
So here in Alberta, we've been working on this, and since about 2014, we have an approved quantification protocol or series of methodologies that must be validated by a neutral third party. in accordance with the standard for validation, verification, and audit. So in short, we have programs that are already in existence in Canada tracking carbon offsets, which would be a farm can measure their carbon, or a ranch, or a feedlot. So they measure their carbon. Are they carbon neutral, carbon net negative, carbon positive? I would argue that most agricultural operations are, for the most part, carbon net neutral, in many cases, carbon net negative. So they will have carbon offsets that so they can trade those carbon offsets as compensation for emission of carbon dioxide and GHGs by major corporations. So there's some of those trading platforms already happening. Carbon credits is more of a cash value type of thing. Can a group of farmers develop a cooperative where they're measuring their carbon sequestration and they're offering it to a major corporation to offset their GHG. So they could put a cash value on it. So there's those that will argue that a carbon offset's the way to go. Another one will argue that it's a carbon credit's the way to go. And they'll fight fiercely about it. And there'll be different ways of measuring it. But at the end of the day, none of them are wrong. It's just there might be one that will turn out ultimately to be more appropriate or more right than another. But you know what? I can't criticize any of these people that are working on these platforms and ways of doing it. And you know, we're working, my company's working on something called the Sustainable Agri-Food Traceability System. So we're moving to other commodities other than beef. And we've got, and we'll be using the Cool Farm tool, Christine, which is a part of the Cool Farm Alliance. We've been working on this for a number of years. At the end of the day, all I see is like you said, Christine, I feel very positive about this. Like everybody has the same end goal. We just have different ways of getting there. And I know if I wanted to drive Roger from your place in Northern California to Christine's, just outside of San Diego, right? That there would be a number of different ways I could drive there. I don't have to take the same road. We can all take different roads, but we'll all arrive at the same goal. And that's to create this a better place, a better planet, a planet that my next generation, my grandchildren, or even my children that are ranching that are now like 40 some years old, that they can be really proud that we took these steps and started them on this path to help control, you know, the damage to our climate and to our environment. Like Christine said, I feel very hopeful. There's so much technology out there. It's exciting to me.
You know, I think that's a good place to wrap up. Although we could continue this conversation. I think it's safe to say those.
All day, Roger.
No, I know. All day. You know, one thing I feel compelled to say, though, is that in trying to head these new directions, there's going to be some fits and starts and some, we're going to do some things that aren't quite right. I mean, I see people trying, like we've got a cap and trade here in California, but some of the people that have agriculture land don't really get credits for planting trees, which are putting, you know, taking more carbon out and sequestering it and so forth. So there's a lot of rough edges to policy that is not quite fitting, and it's going to be work in progress for a while. But I still really like the optimism that we're talking about here, that we're heading a good direction. It's exciting. It's hard to sort out, and there's many more things that we can get into. But we'll have to do it again another time. But in the meantime, I want to give each of you an opportunity to possibly mention a website, yours or others, or someplace that the people that would like to continue to investigate the things that we've talked about and learn more about them. Deb Wilson, where would you suggest that people look, either about your own company or other spots that you think that people that want to continue to understand more about what we're talking about today, where would you suggest they look?
Well, you know, I think that they should come to our website, of course. I'm going to www.trustbix.com. And we talk about a number of the great things we're doing. we're working on, you know, measuring energy usage in large farming operations and in grocery stores. I mean, all these lights and all this type of stuff. So we're really starting to expand our scope within the company. If you want to know about sustainable beef, go to www.crsbeef.com.ca, I think it is. And it's funny, I Google all these things and they just pop up. I don't even know, you know, what the end of the website is. But, you know, if you want to know about carbon credits, like anything you wonder about, just plug it into Google. And the more you do it, the more that's going to come up. And you're going to see that starting to happen over and over again. I mean, we've got so many technology partners that we work with as well. If you're a cow-calf producer, start collecting some data. And you may not know what you're going to do with that data today, but I can tell you in the late 80s, when I first started collecting data, it was a way to implement better record keeping for me. My brother was a tech guy and he came in my office one day and said, "Oh, you need a computer." I said, "Tell me about it." So anyways, we built our first program. We gathered data, and 3 years in, I started to realize what I could do with that data. Once I start to aggregate it and accumulate it, and again, now let's fast forward 20, 30, 40 years, and we're accumulating all kinds of data. And my mind just explodes, Roger, at the thoughts of what we could do with the data we could gather.
I know some of us have been doubters about data, because I never liked math that much. But on the other hand, it's showing up everywhere. Being able to utilize it more efficiently, we even have baseball teams that make it all the way to the World Series right now, when everybody said they shouldn't, but because they were driven by data, like the Moneyball type of
bingo
stories, and it applies to agriculture, food, and farming too. So, Christine, how about you? Where would you suggest people look?
So if you're like me and you're coming from other industries and you really want to learn more about beef, the National Cattlemen's Beef Association is a great place to start, NCBA. And if you're a person from the city trying to break in, the Farm Credit Council is another one I'd look at that has programs for beginning ranchers. From both, you will find many links that connect you outward and locally. So I would encourage you, join NCBA, join your local chapters. If you just search on beef sustainability, you'll find a whole world out there. And then I think I also mentioned CDP. I believe it's cdp.com, if you're interested in the carbon credits. And then lastly, I'd point you to the LARTA Institute. LARTA Institute helps various grant recipients for ag tech and for medical devices that are building companies in the U.S. commercialize their business. So if you're an investor thinking about investment, there are more than 600 companies that LARTA works with that can give you a great connection to what's happening. They have wonderful conferences. That's where I start. And then as you come into this space, you're going to learn so much. The last thing I'd say is see if you can't meet some local ranchers and buy some beef, buy a quarter of beef, get some friends together, buy a freezer. It's amazingly tasty. and take some classes. Learn about where your food comes from, and learn to prepare it yourself beautifully. There was a book by Danica, the race car driver, on how to be healthy, and her advice was learn to be a better chef than your next door restaurant. You know, we're going to eat our whole lives, and if you learn how to cook a beautiful lamb shank or a piece of beef in your Instapot, you get to enjoy that and save money and be healthier. So I'd say get involved, eat well, and live a beautiful life.
Wow, I can't hardly beat that. I'm going to jump in the lineup here with you two and say this time I'm going to post some, whatever you give me on those links that you just were reading to everybody, I'll post it on my website so people want to check out farmtotabletalk.com, and I'll put some, whatever links that Christine and Deb give to me, I'll put those links up as well so they can check it out. And if you've got some other suggestions about our conversation today, go ahead and email us at farmtotabletalk@idea-farming.com. And for other suggestions on how we might continue similar conversations, there's so many places to go with this. I tell you what, this has been a fun conversation. I wish we could do it every day, meet you two for coffee. My guests have been Christine McCray and Deborah Wilson. Thank you for being on Farm to Table Talk.
My pleasure.
Thank you, Roger.
You've been listening to Farm to Table Talk with your host, Roger Wasson. If you like what you hear, go to farmtotabletalk.com and follow us on Facebook and Twitter, or go to iTunes to subscribe and give us a review and a rating. Thanks for listening to Farm to Table Talk with your host, Roger Wasson.